This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There have been attacks with heavy weapons. People have died because of this, and we have also been informed about the destruction of houses as well.
That was Alamu Muheratu, Regional Director for Monitoring and Investigation for Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission, on reports of heavy security measures against protesters in the Amhara region. Details coming up. Also, Britain is getting ready for the coronation of Charles as the new king, and Mali's military government sets June 18th as the new date for a delayed constitutional referendum. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The World Food Programme says it is struggling to get aid to Sudan's capital Khartoum and other areas, seeing intense fighting and multiple failed ceasefires. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan, Sudan.
World Food Programme spokeswoman for Sudan, Lenny Kinsley, said Thursday the agency has started distributing food aid to the people who have fled the fighting in what she described as peaceful locations. Kinsley told VOA by messaging app from Germany, the WFP plans to provide food aid to 384,000 people. She said the aid would go to Sudan's eastern Kassala and Gadarifi states, as well as the White Nile state south of Khartoum.
And this includes newly displaced persons, host communities that are extremely vulnerable, as well as pre-existing refugees that were sheltering in some of these states.
Kinsley said intense fighting in and around Khartoum has prevented safe access to an area where millions of people are struggling to survive. The Associated Press reports heavy shelling in the Sudanese capital Thursday disrupt efforts to deliver badly needed aid to civilians trapped by the warring generals. Sudan's military and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, have agreed to a few ceasefires, but none have taken hold. Kinsley urged both sides to guarantee the safety of aid agencies to deliver assistance.
It makes it very, very difficult for us to provide assistance safely. And so we continue to call on both parties to the conflict to adhere to this ceasefire and to all obligations under international humanitarian law to protect humanitarian staff, humanitarian assistance, and all assets and premises that are belonging to humanitarian organizations.
The fighting since April 15 has killed hundreds of people and sent hundreds of thousands fleeing for safety. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, say Thursday more than 128,000 people have already left Sudan and close to 900,000 are expected to flee to the neighboring countries in the coming weeks. Kinsley said WFP has already provided food aid to more than one-third of the 30,000 Sudanese who fled to Chad. The UNHCR said similar numbers have fled to South Sudan, 47,000 to Egypt, and about 10,000 to the Central African Republic. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
Dr. Mohamed Issa is the Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, a nonprofit that builds links between Sudanese doctors in the U.S. and support health facilities back home. He is one of the many who are caught in the crossfire between the two competing Sudanese military forces last month when fighting broke out 3 days after he arrived in Khartoum to be with his family after his father died. Issa also lost his friend, Dr. Bushra Suleiman, who reportedly was fatally stabbed while taking his father to dialysis in Khartoum. VOA's Carol Van Dam talks to us about this dangerous, relates to us this dangerous and extremely difficult story.
We were making phone calls, hunting random bus drivers for 48 hours until we managed to secure one. And then the bus driver that we found did not want to come and pick us from where we live. He insisted that we meet him in a stationed in Khartoum North, and then we have to travel to him. So that means we will have to find a van to take us from where we live, from our homes to the bus. And that was by itself a dramatic journey, because we had to go through the streets of Khartoum and to go through over a bridge between Khartoum City and Khartoum North to get to the bus station. And there we were stopped multiple times by the RSF soldiers. And we were just searched as we were on the van. But that was the time that when I saw a different picture of Khartoum City. It just looked like a ghost town. Just a scene from a scary movie, to be honest. Dead bodies on the sides, cars that are left with bodies that are dead inside it, houses that are burned and knocked down, until we made it to the station that the bus was driver was stopping at. And that would take us to phase two, taking the bus out of Khartoum State to Port Sudan. Immediately after we left Khartoum North, maybe about 45 minutes, 1 hour out, we were again stopped at gunpoint and we were manually searched. And that happened four times until we left Khartoum State.
Tell us about your friend, the doctor who died all too soon.
Yes, you know, all of what happened and what we have experienced for me was just on one side, and the death of Bushra Suleiman was on a different side. Bushra is a great loss at so many levels and at, you know, at so many angles, given the heroic actions and what Bushra was doing in Sudan. Bushra was a great mentor to myself personally, since we both have the same specialty. And he was a great mentor to his students, to his colleagues, to his trainees, and everyone that he was teaching or everyone he was mentoring. The third part is the humanitarian work Bushra was doing as a part of the Sudanese African Medical Association. He was the director of their office in Sudan, and he was in charge of all their operations in Sudan, going between, you know, delivering and getting shipments of medications and medical supplies from the United States to Sudan, conducting training programs to midwives and to medical professionals across different specialties in Sudan. And Bushra's death shook everybody that knew him.
There's going to be, hopefully, international humanitarian organizations are going to be coming back, not in Khartoum maybe, but in other parts of Sudan where it's a little more safe to try to restart some of their operations. Can you tell us any more what you know about that?
Yes, we have heard about that. And the Red Cross organization managed to get a shipment to Port Sudan right now. And that's the first shipment from an international non-governmental organization that they made it to Sudan. The WHO announced that also they have a shipment that might be coming soon within the next couple of days as well.
That's Dr. Mohamed Issa in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. After leaving Khartoum, he was speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has denounced security measures against protesters in the Amhara region this week that it said led to the deaths of civilians. Maya Misikir reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The government-established Human Rights Commission on Friday condemned the measures taken by Ethiopian security forces in the Amhara region. The commission, which is monitoring operations in the region, reported civilian deaths, though it did not specify how many people were killed. The regional director for monitoring and investigation, Alamo Mehretu, said the commission has received reports of shelling in the Amhara region's North Shawa zone. There have been attacks with heavy weapons. People have died because of this, and we have also been informed about the destruction of houses as well. Roadblocks and tensions are also being reported. We will issue a report and work on interventions when we have the full information. The clashes taking place are between the Ethiopian military and the Amhara region militia, which has set up roadblocks on a major route to the capital. Protests in Amhara started in early April, following government calls to integrate regional forces into the military or the police. Regional Amhara Special Forces fought alongside the Ethiopian government during the two-year war in the neighboring Tigray region. The government's law enforcement operations have also targeted opposition members accused of inciting protesters, according to the Human Rights Commission. Attempts to reach the region's communications director went unanswered. Maya Misakir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
While King Charles III, 74, has ruled since his mother Queen Elizabeth II died in September, he will be crowned tomorrow as monarch of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, as well as becoming the largely ceremonial head of the Commonwealth. Henry Ridgewell in London is closely monitoring the proceedings. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Henry. Henry?
Yes, can you hear me? It's yes. Henry in London.
Yes, yes. Welcome to Africa News Tonight. I'm guessing with the preparations and anticipations, the mood where you are is probably very festive. Talk to us about the significance of this coronation.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's great anticipation in the country. Of course, we haven't witnessed a coronation here since 1953. With the crowning of Queen Elizabeth II. So for most people in this country, it's a first event and a once-in-a-lifetime event, really. The significance is largely ceremonial. King Charles III became monarch right upon the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, on September 8th last year. So he has had that role since then. He has met several heads of state in his role as the British monarch since then, including, for example, the president of South Africa. But this will see him really receive the official imperial crown. It will see him and Queen Consort Camilla, his wife, be taken from Buckingham Palace through crowds, tens of thousands of people lining the route to Westminster Abbey, where the first coronation took place of William the Conqueror back in 1066. So that gives you some idea of the history of this event. The actual ceremonial part dates back even before that to around 916 AD. We will see some of those historical events unchanged during the ceremony itself. The actual events are in many ways extraordinary. The processional cross includes fragments of what's believed to be the true cross upon which Jesus was crucified, donated by Pope Francis. There is holy oil brought from Jerusalem, for example, to anoint the king. And then once the ceremony is finished, he will be taken by, again, royal carriage back to Buckingham Palace.
And Henry, does the relationship of Charles and Africa, I think it goes back a long way, doesn't it?
Yes, he has always, I think, in his heart and in his mind, had a close relationship with the African continent, as has the British monarchy across the course of the last decades. Of course, his mother, Elizabeth, was in Kenya when, upon the death of her father, King George, when she became queen in 1952, and she quickly travelled back once that had happened. But Charles himself, yes, he feels very close to the continent, and he realises, I think, that the relationship between Britain and particularly the British monarchy and the Commonwealth and Africa has to change and move with the times. And those are questions that I think will loom large across his reign. He has already spoken of the need for the monarchy to confront its history, its links to the slave trade, for example, for it to confront issues, for example, of reparations. If you look at the suppression of the Mau Mau uprising in Kenya in the 1950s, for example, Britain has already paid out compensation to some of the victims of that repression. I think we will see more conversation around issues like that, around the legacy of empire and monarchy. Charles has shown a willingness to do so. But I think the question is whether there will be any action to follow those words. And those who want that action, for example, compensation, reparations, the return of some of the valuable items that were plundered under empire and taken under the wing of the British monarchy, if you like, for example, some of the jewels on the Queen Elizabeth's crown and scepter came from South Africa and were taken under colonial rule. Will there be a conversation about returning those things? But also, will King Charles remain the head of state of the 15 remaining Commonwealth nations where he is now? There is a strong debate in countries, including Australia, Canada, many countries in the Caribbean, about removing him as head of state and then becoming republics. So while tomorrow will be a day of celebration here in Britain and around the world, and there will be a global audience of millions, there is much debate ahead about the role of the monarchy.
VOA's Henry Ridgewald in London, closely monitoring the upcoming coronation. Thank you for your input, Henry.
Good to be with you.
As reported, tomorrow, billions will watch the coronation of Charles III and his wife Camilla as King and Queen of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth. As Darren Taylor reports, there'll be more than a few African elements mixed in with the pomp and ceremony.
When King Charles and Queen Camilla take to their respective thrones, their crowns will hold several of South Africa's most famous diamonds. And on the stage at Westminster Abbey will be another glittering African gem in the form of internationally renowned South African soprano, Priti Yende. It was this performance as Violetta in Verdi's classic opera La Traviata at the Royal Opera House in London in April last year that caught the then Prince Charles's attention.
He was sitting right here on my left when I'm on stage, because I always like to see the audience when I'm performing on stage, so I could see everybody smile. But of course, my attention was, of course, on the king. And I was watching and hoped that he's pleased, and I would see smiles, I would see warmth. And of course, at the end of the performance, I got to meet him in person. We shook hands, and he was so warm and so kind. He was so complimentary. And
in January, Yende took a call from London and heard a familiar voice.
The very same king of the kings of so many monarchs, King Charles, has asked me to sing at the Westminster Abbey for his coronation. I mean, it's a dream come true. It's an honor as an artist, and I'm really excited for it, and I cannot wait to be there.
Now 38, Yende was inspired to begin singing opera as a teenager when she saw a British Airways TV ad at home in the small town of Pitt Retief. The spot featured one of the world's greatest opera compositions, the Flower Duet.
In 2001, I was 16, and that memory is really, really embedded in my soul. Every fiber of my being can still hear those two voices behind the ad, because I didn't know it was humanly possible or it was human voices until my high school teacher, music teacher at the time, told me that, yes, Priti, it's called opera and it's humanly possible.
Yende studied music at the University of Cape Town before being awarded a bursary for the opera school at La Scala in Milan. Her big break came in 2013. Yende remembers being in Russia when someone from the New York Metropolitan Theatre phoned her. The soprano billed to sing the part of Countess Adele in Rossini's Le Comte Ore was ill and unable to perform. At the age of just 27 and after a mere 3 weeks' preparation, Yende took to the stage in New York and gave a performance that stunned the opera world. Today, she's the winner of many international awards and has graced all the world's big stages, with opera legends including Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli. Yende says she'll dedicate her performance at the coronation to her deceased grandmother.
You know, when I look back, thinking about the first days of my singing life at home with my family and my grandmother teaching me how to sing in the church, you know, hearing those grandmothers in the church saying, one day you're going to sing in front of billions. One day you're going to sing for many, many, many. Well, the prophecy has come true.
Tomorrow, says Yende, she'll be singing to the King and Queen. But she'll be singing for Africa, because that's where her voice was born. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Kenyan President William Ruto today appointed a commission of inquiry into the deaths of more than 100 people believed to have starved themselves to death under the direction of an alleged cult leader. Authorities say the dead were members of the Good News International Church led by Paul Mackenzie, who they say predicted the world would end on April 15th and instructed his followers to kill themselves to be the first to go to heaven. Reuters says the death toll stands at 111 but could rise further. Mackenzie has not commented publicly on the accusations or required to enter a plea to any criminal charge. He was ordered today to remain in prison for an additional 60 days pending further investigations. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 50 years since the war between the United States and Vietnam ended, and nearly 28 years since the two countries normalized relations. In that time, the two nations have forged a relationship that is robust, dynamic, and consequential, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken during a recent visit to Hanoi. His focus, said Secretary Blinken, remained on how the United States can continue to support Vietnam's success, which is good for the Vietnamese people, for Americans, and indeed for the entire region.
Our countries are collaborating on an incredibly broad range of shared interests, and we believe that by supporting Vietnam's ambitions, we advance our own, from the creation of American jobs and the strengthening of American businesses, to progress on the climate crisis that affects all of us, to preventing pandemics.
The United States and Vietnam work together on the international stage to promote broad-based prosperity in Vietnam and throughout the region, said Secretary Blinken. We're also growing our bilateral economic partnership, he said.
The U.S. is helping Vietnam double down on key reforms it's embraced, including on labor, intellectual property, fair trade, which have made it one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. We believe that Vietnam can achieve its goal of becoming a connected, high-income country by 2045, by pursuing growth that lifts up all communities while building resilience to adapt to climate change.
Indeed, we know Vietnam is increasingly vulnerable to threats posed by the climate crisis, said Secretary Blinken.
As Vietnam takes steps to become a leader on climate energy transition, the United States is investing in that tremendous potential. We're launching new bilateral climate initiatives, which do everything from conserving ecosystems and reducing emissions from rice farming in the Mekong Delta to expanding a market-driven clean energy system and scaling up adoption of electric vehicles, to leveraging our private sectors to drive climate action.
And last but not least, we're finalizing the transfer of the third U.S. Coast Guard cutter to Vietnam, complementing a fleet of 24 patrol boats and other equipment, training, and operational facilities that we have provided since 2016. All of these efforts bolster Vietnam's capacity to contribute to maritime peace and stability in the South China Sea, said Secretary Blinken. The United States is committed to supporting a strong, prosperous, independent, and resilient Vietnam, and we respect Vietnam's rights to shape its future under its own political system.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.